From downtown Milwaukee, welcome to Money Talk with Bob Landis. Each week, professional advisors from Landis & Company Investments discuss the latest financial developments, offering timely insight and long-term perspective.
This is Money Talk for February 22nd, 2019. Well, after a long off-season, it's finally here. The Brewers and the Cubs start Cactus League play tomorrow in Arizona. Now, if you're into cars, it's the World of Wheels this weekend at State Fair Park, and the auto show is at the Convention Center. Well, a New Jersey burglar, after trying to break into a house, called for an Uber to make his getaway. So what's wrong with this picture? Well, the answer is the cops beat the Uber driver to the house. And in his panic, this rocket scientist jumped into a cop car thinking it was his Uber ride. I'm thinking he probably didn't give the driver a very good rating either. And finally, this year, lots of people are complaining about their small tax refunds, but not this guy in Tampa. He filed his tax return and claimed $18,500 as his income. In return, the IRS sent him a refund check that was just short of $1 million. So what are the odds the IRS made a mistake? Well, before they figure it out, I'm filing my tax return right at the end of this podcast. In the studio today, we have Chris Evers, Tom Papenfuss, Brian Kilb, Joel Dreesang, and wrapping up the week, here's Kyle Tedding.
Well, thanks, Max. Friday's gains propelled the Dow and NASDAQ to their ninth straight week of positive performance after Thursday's losses had put the streak in jeopardy. Following the strong start to 2019, the S&P sits roughly 5% below its all-time high set in September of last year. If equity prices hold through next week, this will mark the largest climb in the S&P 500 for the first 2 months of the year since 1991. Not coincidentally, this follows the worst month of December for U.S. stocks since the 1930s. On the trade front, U.S.-China talks continue as the March 1st deadline approaches. However, the president indicated that the deadline could be extended, and we continue to see signs the two countries are working toward an agreement. Minutes from the January Federal Reserve meeting were released on Wednesday. Fed officials once again stressed patience in evaluating the need of future rate hikes and discussed a conclusion to an unwinding of the balance sheet. For another good week, the S&P 500 closed the week at 2,793, up 0.6% for the week and up 11.6% for the year. The NASDAQ closed the week at 7,524, up 0.7% for the week and 13.5% for the year. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average up 182 points today to close at 26,032. That's up 11.9% for the year and 0.6% for the week. And the 10-year Treasury moved slightly down to close the week at 2.66%. And that's a quick look at the week in review. You know, Brian, I think we've gotten a bit of news this week from the Fed with the Fed minutes. We continue to see some hopefully good signs that a trade agreement is on the horizon, and the market just continues to rally on, you know, maybe not good news, but certainly no more bad news, no more uncertainties out there. Are we finally getting what we want?
You know, Kyle, I think there's a couple different answers to that. I think a lot of angst gets kind of misdirected to things that don't matter, at least don't matter in the context of where we are today. But then, of course, certain things do matter, right? I think China matters. You know, I think obviously the impact potentially on the extension of these tariffs or even increasing these tariffs is a big deal. And, you know, there's a domino effect there between how it might affect global trade. But even I think in terms of, you know, kind of giving us a great sense of unease about our ability to negotiate, you know, between the two biggest, you know, economic powers in the world. So I think the stakes for that deal are pretty deep, you know, and pretty firm. And the outcome will have a meaningful impact on where we go with markets forward. You know, now, on the other hand, you take something like the Brexit and you go, you know, okay, 2.5 years later, we really have no better understanding potentially what might happen than we do 2.5 years ago. In fact, you know, they're spitting off some of the the parliamentarians are kind of spinning off to form their own party. They're kind of actually interested in pushing an agenda that suggests they go back and vote this thing all over again. So, you know, if you're able to separate the things that matter and the things that don't matter right now and focus on on those. I think you're getting to a point where there's a few of those issues that are right now in the crosshairs. China, we're going to learn something in the next couple of weeks. As to the bond market, we really haven't moved at all this year, and there may be a reason for that in terms of the Fed changing its tone a little bit. Maybe now we're not anticipating, maybe one increase, maybe none. But I don't know that the bond markets reacted potentially to the change in economic circumstances to the degree that stocks have in the fourth quarter and now in the first quarter.
Yeah, Brian, I think that's such an important point to remember as we look at kind of the bond market. You look at the fourth quarter of 2018, this horrible quarter for stock returns, and yet the bond piece did exactly what we would have thought it should have done. The Treasuries held up. In fact, the Treasuries rallied in that fourth quarter, and so investors had a place to turn to if they needed a little bit of cash. They had a place to hide. And then now you're talking about what could be one of the best two-month stretches in quite a long time for stocks. And, you'd think, okay, maybe bonds come back the other way. And so, maybe there's some signs that something else is going on in the bond market. Tom, you and I were talking about that a little bit before the show. I wonder if you've got maybe any thoughts about maybe what the bond market is telling us now versus what the stock market is telling us.
Yeah, I think usually when you're looking at yields and when yields are a bit higher, they're trending higher, usually it's a sign of, optimism for longer-term growth expectations in the bond markets. I think what we saw, what was really interesting and some clients had pointed out, towards the end of 2018, amidst the sell-off when that started to begin, people saw their stock portfolios start to decline. At the same time, we already went through a correction. The market had recovered at the beginning of 2018, but yield interest rates were increasing. So that was downward pressure on bond prices. So now we're seeing in their bond funds negative returns, and now starting to see their positive stock returns start to slide. And so there was a period of, in their eyes, when you open up your portfolio, of kind of some correlation there. But now come 2019, and we're looking at stock prices that have rallied quite a bit, and bonds are looking pretty good as far as total returns are concerned. But as far as yields coming down, it's a sign that uncertainty is pretty high right now, and a little bit concerned.
If you go back to the first quarter of last year, the bond market significantly reacted to the increase in interest rates, and since then everybody's kind of what we kind of thought would happen has happened, and as to where we go from here, perhaps our expectations for rate increases have changed. But what the bond market hasn't reacted to is potentially the economy starting to slow down. And what I mean by that is a deterioration in credit. We haven't had any kind of interest rate impact because potentially companies may lose their ability to pay us back on a timely basis. Whereas I think if you go back to the stock market in the fourth quarter, obviously reacted significantly to potentially the slowdown in. So I think the disconnect there is, you've seen a lot more volatility in stocks because of that correlation between potentially what may happen with global growth and what may not, where I think mostly in the bond market, it's probably just anticipating kind of the interest rate scenario and maybe kind of ignoring potential credit problems that may be around the corner.
Well, Brian, I think we put a bit of a ceiling on interest rates last year when we saw how much the rest of the world was ready to step in and take down, a 10-year treasury that passed 3%. When you look at what you could get in much of the rest of the developed world, and certainly in the rest of the high-quality developed world, that 3% looked pretty tasty. It looked pretty attractive. And so, you had a hard time pushing much higher when everything looked really rosy. And now we're talking about an economy that, if we're lucky, might grow 2% this year based on what a lot of the forecasts are saying, and certainly predicting that maybe by the end of this year and certainly by the end of next that we'll be, feeling the effects of something like a recession. I think that points to, a 10-year that probably has a hard time moving significantly past, where it was last year. And at the same time, I think you're absolutely right. It's just a sign of, of what we see.
And it speaks to the point I'm talking about. If we all assumed that the 10-year wasn't going anywhere for a while, and then you look at the issuance of debt in Italy, for instance, right? So there's still people are buying those bonds left and right, and they're paying 3-something, not significantly a greater yield than you get here. That isn't going to last forever. At some point in time, somebody's going to realize that Italy's a little more of a risk than the U.S. And when that happens, those yields will seek their true ground, and that's going to be damaging in the bond market. Now, I'm not suggesting in any way that that happens here, but there will be some modest effect, perhaps, when credit quality deteriorates.
Yeah, I think there's a good point there, Brian, that there's really no mechanism to push U.S. Treasury substantially higher from a rate perspective. As long as global yields stay incredibly low, the Fed is somewhat signaled, barring any type of large uptick in inflation. They almost feel like they're nearly at, you know, what they would call a normal level of short-term rates. So without short-term rates moving much higher due to the Fed's actions, foreign buyers and lower rates around the globe, you mean you got pressure from foreign purchasers on treasuries, as well as in the most recent minutes, the Fed somewhat indicated that even the balance sheet unwind, which is a little bit more of an obscure thing in one of the actions that they've had, it appears like they're going to slow down on the unwinding of that balance sheet and getting closer to the point in which they're done, essentially allowing some of those treasuries to roll off the book, which would hypothetically not greatly increase the amount of treasuries out on the market and allow for prices to recover.
You know, I think it's such an interesting topic to talk about quite regularly, and I think one we talk about pretty frequently just because, you know, it is the piece of investors' portfolios that's supposed to be the piece that holds up so well. I mean, you know, again, as we saw last year, exactly what we would have expected, and, you know, I don't think we're too surprised by where we are this year given a lot of the economic data we've seen. You know, Tom, one of the other things we talked about before the webcast was this idea, I think, that we brought up on the podcast last week about being a global investor and kind of the role that currency plays in that and maybe, you know, how you might get some non-U.S. exposure. And I think the piece that you have reminded me of is that it's more than just, you know, the country of domicile that you're investing in, that there's other ways to get exposure outside the U.S.
Right. I think it's, you know, we always preach diversification for all of our clients, and when it's important to think of how you can be diversified, and you have to also, you know, and Bob will always point out that understanding where different companies are generating the revenues from, where are you getting emerging markets exposure, and you know, about, I think the latest number I saw as far as you look at S&P 500 revenues, about 60% is domestic and about 40% is overseas. So, you know, while there is heightened concerns, and I've, you know, clients, you know, have expressed to me their concern about global growth, you know, declining and being reduced, and, you know, that they want a lower non-U.S. exposure and how it shows up in our Morningstar analysis reports, but you're still getting plenty of exposure as well from even just having broad-based U.S. stock exposure.
Yeah, so important to remember, I think, that much of the world's consumption is consumption of American-made products, and so you can get exposure to that just simply by buying, you know, a U.S.-based company. And then, you know, the funny thing about that conversation is right after you and I had that, then, you know, Chris mentioned to me, well, yeah, but we still do have this issue of home country bias, and there's some places where just being a U.S. investor maybe excludes some exposure that you might otherwise be able to get. And so, Chris, I wonder if you might, you know, maybe touch a little bit on some of the issues with being too focused here in the U.S.
Yeah, and I think this expands even outside the U.S. So there's been quite a few studies that have shown a home country bias, or even just a home area bias, call it that, where, for example, Japanese individuals tend to invest more heavily in Japanese equities. You know, obviously the perspective here in the United States, a lot of American investors have a focus on American equities, and even on a more granular level, I'm sure people that live in the Milwaukee area maybe hold stock in companies in the Milwaukee area that is at a higher proportion than what the average investor is. So it's a reminder that people tend to invest in what they're familiar with. That may not always mean that it's the right investment choice, because you're making a decision just based off of familiarity. Or, for example, as an American investor, maybe you benchmark against S&P 500. That's what you pay attention to. So you're generally going to invest in local companies and U.S. companies. But it's important to remember that even though the U.S. equity market has really been the strength over the last decade or so, that may not necessarily be the case, and that there might be better opportunities abroad, and that you can't let the bias of investing in your own home market really just drive the decisions. You have to make sure you're making a rational decision.
So, Chris, in some ways, I mean, you know, I've always heard you should invest in what you know. So that's what you're talking about, but it's also a matter of you don't know what you don't know, and so you might be missing out.
Well, and I think it's important for investors to remember, Joel, that, you know, there are some pretty significant correlation benefits to investing in particular industries that maybe we don't have exposure as much to here in the U.S. And, you know, it's as simple as looking at a company you know, like Total, a French energy company, where you can't get exposure to that market via Wisconsin Electric or Wisconsin Energies or buying Duke Energy or whatever U.S.-based energy maker you are. And so if you think that growth in France might accelerate, as just an example, the only way to participate in that directly is to find some stuff that maybe isn't domiciled here in the U.S. And so, you know, you can increase the correlation benefits of your portfolio just by finding areas that maybe you couldn't otherwise get exposure to here in the U.S.
You know, and I don't, the whole issue of like global investing and everything too, it's not just what you know, but it's the capacity to know things. Because, you know, when I first started doing this, you know, what did you know about China? You know, and what was your capacity to learn about China? You know, and I think one of these things that the trade agreement does is it brings us closer together, right? You know, we've negotiated some kind of settlement, if indeed that happens. We've learned more about the other folks. There's so much more transparency because of the internet and other ways that we communicate. So, you know, the risks involved in going somewhere where you didn't have any kind of, you know, headquarters or some research base or whatever, it's just different now, you know, and there's an ability to learn a lot more about the rest of the world, which I think kind of, to some degree, over time, will continue to kind of dissipate the difference and the risks associated with just where you are in the world, you know.
I think all of this is very behavioral in terms of, you know, being able to tolerate the risk of, you know, foreign investments compared to the stuff that you might be better able to understand here in the U.S. or just that you're more comfortable with exposure to. And so I think there's, you know, this element of where does behavioral finance, where does behavioral investing come in? Chris, I know you look at that quite a bit. I wonder, you know, if you take away any behavioral investing lessons from those conversations or others, or if there's anything, you know, in particular that you might want to share.
Yeah, sure. I've spent a fair amount of time really over the last 6 months or so thinking personally about, you know, I really should have a list of personal investing maxims or prism or principles that, you know, I hold true that I'm going to stick to no matter what the circumstance is. And as I was thinking about this really, you know, over the last few months and especially in the fourth quarter, I came to realize that it's really important to have a base belief of something. So I think about the fourth quarter with the sell-off. It's important to lean on something that you strongly believe. You know, for example, as investors, I think we all strongly believe that, in general, equity markets go up over long periods of time. And that's, you know, typically because businesses are profitable, and we can talk about interest rates and earnings and all that. But a general belief in markets and the way that markets function. So it's important in those tough times to be able to lean on something that you hold true, that you, you know, believe in. You know, just as in really in your personal life, you would think about when you go through a difficult time, you have some sort of something core to yourself that you can rely on, whether it's friends, family, or whatever that may be. And I think it definitely ties to more of a behavioral aspect, because when it comes down to decision making, often if you don't have anything core to hold on to, you're kind of just reactionary in your decisions. You see the market go down, you react to it. You don't go back and take a step away and say, well, what do I really believe about the market? And why should the current market prices change that thought process?
And Kyle, you talked about that on the podcast last week about how investments tend to do better than investors because investors behave and investments, you know, are just sort of sticking with it in the long run.
You know, I think it gets back to kind of Landis & Company's core investment philosophy, something that's been proven, you know, not just academically, but proven for investors that, you know, modern portfolio theory works, that picking an allocation, picking a balanced portfolio that you're comfortable with, that will allow you to ride through some of that uncertainty, has been proven time and time again to allow the investor's return to line up, Joel, with the investment return. And so I think, you know, if you can overcome some of those behavioral objectives, some of the signals that might make you want to run from, you know, from risk or run toward those things that you might be overly optimistic about. I mean, it's this you know, the theory of modern portfolio theory over time that has allowed us to do that.
Well, and if I may, I mean, it's beyond even investment philosophy. It's a belief in capitalism to some degree, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, I think how you define that over the years may change, but I think we'd all agree that we're all just trying to serve people, to make something somebody wants, to perhaps make some money doing that while creating jobs and opportunities for our neighbors and our friends and stuff, right? And I think if you believe in a free market, that to do that successfully, you're rewarded for that, and that you're able to share those gifts with people. That's what this is. So when the times get tough, you know, if you understood or have faith in capitalism, you're ultimately going to have faith that earnings will be there, and interest rates will be there, and these other things. And I think that's what's always given me the most solid foundation in this. Is I just kind of believe that we're all trying to do the right thing, and we're going to be successful at the end of the day. And as a result, we're all going to be to share in those rewards. You know, so.
Joel, a few economic releases this week. Anything? At the top of your list?
Well, you know, we're seeing more indications that, as you said before, that the economic growth is probably, you know, slowing down, that we have the leading economic indicators. So it's interesting, we had 5 days that, the markets were closed on Monday, but we still had 5 work days this week, and all the indicators came out on Thursday, which that doesn't happen all that often. But the economic, the leading indicators that the conference board comes out with, those actually showed a decline for January, and there was no change in December. They basically have been going sideways since October. So that's a bit of a trend. I mean, that's a few months, put that together. And the economists at the conference board, you know, look at all of these indicators, and again, some of them aren't all that up to date because they rely on some government data, and some of those are still lagging a little bit because of the government shutdown. But the conference board now is forecasting that for 2019, the GDP is going to grow about 2%. So, you know, that's a little bit kind of average what it's been since the end of the recession. It's going to be a little bit slower than it was last year. But it's not recessionary. I mean, it's not, we're not contracting, we're still expanding. But again, I mean, you know, we're seeing all sorts of other indications. Home sales from the National Association of Realtors, those were down. They slowed down in January, and that was the third month in a row that that's happened. And the realtors are a little more optimistic about their thinking that that's maybe going to be the low point. It's going to start picking up again, but you know, we'll wait to see that. The durable goods orders is an interesting, and that's a very volatile number, but it's a sign of manufacturing strength, and that, you know, looked pretty good for the second month in a row. One part that's in those numbers is looking at business investments, and that it's a proxy for that, and that over the last half year or so, that's been lagging a little, and you know, if we want to keep momentum going in manufacturing and in employment and in wages and in productivity, you know, it'd be nice to see more confidence from corporations investing in their infrastructure.
And maybe this is where we come full circle a little bit from what we were talking about at the beginning of, you know, the podcast. And, you know, if manufacturing is as big of a piece of the economy as it is, and yet, you know, you've got manufacturers getting the benefits of tax cuts and then getting hit by tariffs, seeing, you know, the maybe potential wage inflation because of how low unemployment has been, and yet at the same time they just haven't been spending, and so we haven't seen inflation really make its way through the system. You know, if we get them to lean one way or the other a little more than they have, you know, we might see the economy do a little bit better than we expect, or maybe do a little bit worse than we expect. But I think such an interesting sign that, you know, yeah, things are slowing, but nothing's pointing to kind of an imminent recession.
You know, and I think China is not just important because of the implications of tariffs or overall economic, you know, trade, but it's also important because I think it sends a signal that we're able to do things or we aren't, you know. And I think, you know, people talk about whether China is baked in or the markets or isn't baked in the markets, but I think there's a subtlety to it that I'm going to be really interested to see, that if they do resolve something, if they're able to meet in the middle somewhere, not only does it maybe do we carve out a good deal, but it really sends a message that two of the biggest powers in the world that heretofore have been somewhat in conflict can work together. And I think that sends a bigger message than anything. And I look forward to seeing where the markets go if that happens.
Well, Max, you mentioned the Brewers in your open. I think probably the Bucks are going to take a little bit of the steam away from the early part of the Brewers season here if we continue to have the number one team in the NBA. You add in, you know, Marquette men and Marquette women. You add in UW that's had a pretty good basketball program. And I think we might not be talking about Brewers baseball till well into June at this point. So
I'm talking about it.
Well, that's the end of yet another Money Talk. Have a great week.
Thank you for listening to Money Talk with Bob Landis. If you have a financial question you want answered on next week's show, email it to moneytalk@landis.com. To keep informed throughout the week, visit our Money Talk page at landis.com.